Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation. You are about to listen to the Dork Forest. Let's give you the info about it. First of all, you know the websites. DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, if you like a determiner, JackieCation.com has everything. All of my podcasts, including videos of my stand-up schedule, merchandise you can purchase if you would like, and a lot more info than you possibly even need. Let's do the credits. Mike Rickberg sang and produced and composed that song at the beginning of the show. He sang with his wife, Sarah. It's very beautiful. At the end of the program, he sings his version of the Mexican Hat Dance. That's Mike Rickberg. Vilmos fixes JackieCation.com. He is the web designer over there. And Patrick Brady fixes the audio. And in this case, there's a video intro. Very exciting. Anyway, those are the websites. If you want to support the show, you're doing it already by listening to it or watching it. And another way is to tell your friends and family, go on iTunes, do a review. Another way is to just give me money. Yeah. You could go use the donate button. You can make it even monthly if you're okay with making things monthly. You do a PayPal monthly. There's a monthly choice on PayPal. The PayPal is a button on the Jackie Cation or the Dork Forest website, and it goes directly to me. Thank you very much. I will use it wisely or foolishly. Your call as well. Now, my email address, jackie@jackiecation.com, is where you can contact me if you have any questions or concerns and about the Dork Forest. And I do have a Venmo account. It's jackie-cation, oddly enough. Another way to support the show is on dorkforest.com and jackiecation.com. There's an Amazon link. And the Amazon link just takes you to Amazon. You order like normal, and it supports the show because you came from Jackie Cation or dorkforest.com. Very exciting. Other than that, there is a Bandcamp. You can, if you have listened to all the episodes that are free and you need more content, there are several live episodes that are at thedorkforest.bandcamp.com. And those cost me a couple of bucks, so I charge a couple of bucks. There's also a storytelling album there that you can listen to some stories that I did live. And there are 17 free episodes before the Dork Forest was pre-recorded. So the audio isn't very good, but the guests were super funny and fun and dorky. So if you want to do that, go to thedorkforest.bandcamp.com. Other than that, let's see if there are other things that I should be talking about. Possibly the merch. Yeah, if you want to buy merch. The only other thing I want to talk about is the merch. You can get Dork Forest t-shirts, and you can get stand-up comedy t-shirts. You can get my albums or my DVD over at jackiecation.com/merch. There's pins, there's a challenge coin, there's a bunch of new things happening over there. Anyway, a lot of information. I don't think I've missed anything, but who cares? Let's get into the show. Hi, I'm Jackie Cation. I'm in my living room. No, I'm not. I'm actually in the weird garage room. And you seem to be in a sunroom of some sort in the Melbourne, Australia area. Is that correct? Nellie Thomas.
In the Melbourne, Australia area.
Sorry, Melbourne. Melbourne.
Melbourne. Melbourne, Australia.
Melbourne, Australia.
Do you know what's so funny? Every time I talk to you, my accent gets stronger. Because people generally think when I travel, they think I'm English. Because the Australian accent from Western Australia is not as strong.
Ah.
It's got a more of an English influence. But when I talk to you or my other American friends, I start talking like this. No, I just, bloody Australia, mate.
All of a sudden, it's the man from Snowy River right in front of my face.
Worse. It's like, that's not a knife. This is a bloody knife.
Oi.
So I'm actually sitting in my dining room.
Okay.
So it's not really a sunroom, but there's a lot of glass to my left.
Right. There's a fair amount of sun happening.
Yeah. So I think you call it fall, I believe. We're in autumn, and it's 19 degrees today, which is for Melbourne absolutely delightful. And it's our first week with slightly eased restrictions.
Okay.
So the excitement is palpable about being outside in sunshine.
Right. And our people are still being, because we're, I mean, here's what happened. I figure I'm doing all these on Zoom anyway. Let's talk to a dork that's literally 9 time zones away. So
honestly,
it's already Saturday there. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's full on Saturday.
Oh, it's Saturday afternoon and like it is sweet.
It's a pretty sweet Saturday. I mean, something to look forward to.
I'm not homeschooling, mate. Like Monday to Friday, I'm dealing with 2 kids, 1 in high school, 1 in primary school, trying to work out online learning. I can't even work out Instagram. So, like,
right.
It's a lot.
It turns out everything is a learned skill and everything is a skill. So,
really?
Yeah. So as you learn to do that skill, you are going to be shitty at it initially.
Yeah.
I've been talking to a lot of parents. Dang it. I would quote this woman's joke, but I can't remember her last name. So why don't I leave it be?
Okay.
But it was a great Mother's Day joke. Her first name's Emily. Yeah. That's not enough info. Nellie Thomas, we met when you were doing stand up full time.
Yes.
You were doing.
Yes.
Yeah. And we met at the Melbourne Comedy
Thank
Festival.
You.
You're welcome.
Yes.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah. You know what? Speak however you want. I get it. I hear it.
You
it's
hear it.
All right.
It's like when I, with the word Oregon isn't pronounced yeah. Oregon. It's Oregon. and Wisconsin, yeah. And Milwaukee is not Milwaukee. It's Milwaukee. No L. So there's a lot
I'll say the L. Okay. I'll pick that up. See, Oregon, I know because of there's been a lot of right to life stuff that's filtered through our press. So
sure.
We hear Oregon a lot, yes.
Yeah, you'll get it. So Nellie, yeah. But people can still go to NellieThomas.com and see sort of your writing and they can see what's happening, right?
Who cares, Jackie? Seriously. Just listen to his chat. Who gives a shit? Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, fucking A. Do what you
okay.
need to. It's
fantastic. I mean, I've done radio, I've done TV, I've done stand-up, I write books, like, but whatever, who gives a shit?
Right.
Let's just fucking chat.
It's let's chat. And so I have a whole thing where I'm like, I want to know what you're dorking out about recently. And you have a rabbit hole of essentially scrabbling around in other people's brain boxes.
Yeah.
You are a brain meddler, is what you are.
Yeah.
And so you wrote me the most cryptic dorkdom I think I've received in a while, which is...
I thought it was so self-explanatory.
It's so big. It's like when somebody says, oh, man, I could dork out about music. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'm going to need specifics. What genre?
But do you know why? And you will understand this as a stand-up. Like, it's like contestants on Survivor, which was the other topic I was going to choose to dork out on, but I left.
Okay.
It's like they've got a very specific set of skills that apply literally nowhere else.
Right.
So my skill in life is that I can take really weirdly complex ideas and make them understandable. This helps nowhere except on this podcast.
Oh, this will be very, very, very good. So what you, but literally the two words that I got from you were belief systems. I like to dork out about belief systems.
I
was like, oh my God.
I do.
If it could be, could you pick a century? The belief systems of the 18th century, the belief century.
You know what? A good idea doesn't care which century it came from.
Okay.
You can quote me on that.
I think we are. We're definitely going to quote you on this. It's so what? But then I was like, I'm going to need. So yeah, like this guy. This guy sounds like he's old. Michael Foucault. Michel Foucault. He is a French philosopher. So what is? Who is this person?
This is Michel Foucault.
Oh, excellent. He has a Michel. Thank you.
My pronunciation was not correct, but definitely better than yours.
Duolingo is very sad that I've given up on my French.
On your French.
Yes.
One of my favorite jokes of my own, which again will show the niche nature of my stand-up because literally no one cared, was, you know, Foucault about Foucault, which I just thought was a wonderful pun with a swear in it in a highbrow way, but it fell dead every time, about as dead as your face is looking right now.
Right. I'm not getting it either. You know what's going to be great? I'm going to get a lot of emails from Rangers going,
Foucault,
I got
fuck
it.
Fuck all.
Fuck all. For
you know Foucault about Foucault.
Well, I say keep. Hey? I say commit to it. Keep writing.
Yeah, keep punching.
Don't
keep punching.
Never give up. Never surrender. I had a joke about Yugoslavia that finally started working after Yugoslavia had been disbanded.
I tell you what, in isolation, I'm expanding my borders, but that's a whole other conversation.
I see what you did there. See.
Oh,
I
someone has got to eat that sourdough, mate. So Michel Foucault, the reason I chose, because you made me, forced me against my will.
Oh, I did.
To narrow the subjects down. Michel Foucault, his work had a profound effect on me at uni. So just at university, to give you a very brief background, the only thing you need to know is that I was the first person in my family to go to university. So I don't have a background of people sitting around talking about philosophy. Like, I literally remember my nana, who's the love of my life, watching me read a book one day and saying, Nellie, what else do you need to know? You know, it's like, why are you reading? Why do you keep talking about things? And then I get to university and I started in engineering because it was the early 90s. I had been good at maths. And at that time, you're a girl who's good at maths and science, you must be an engineer.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I didn't want to be one. So
that's steady work, though. If you would have got in on the ground floor, I'm sure somebody was telling you that there you should get a backup plan, and engineering is definitely a backup plan.
It's occurred to me a couple of times that it might have served me well to stick to that degree.
It turns out you're fine. You have.
It turns out I'm totally fine.
You're totally.
Look
you have
me,
a
I'm
dining
sitting
room.
In the sunroom.
You have. Yeah. You have plants behind you. You're indoors. You've already won.
I'm fine. So when I basically what I'm getting to is I pulled out of engineering, and because I was already into semester, I had limited subjects to choose from. I literally had never heard. I didn't know what philosophy meant. Like if you said to me, oh, do a degree in philosophy or politics, I would have gone, I don't know what that is. But that's what was left, Jackie. So that's what I did.
I love falling into a degree or a course of study or a job that you're just like,
yeah,
no, someone offered me that. And then now that's what I've been doing for 37 years.
Exactly what happened with stand-up as well, but that's another
Well, and that makes sense. Right. So you studied philosophy because it was what was available.
Yes, but I loved it. My God, I loved it. Like I never could have explained what it was, but one of the people who I never would have discovered was Michel Foucault. And Foucault, I mean, how to sum up a body of work from someone that magnificent
when
is
did
difficult.
He live? Did he live in France?
Yes, he was French. He was probably most famous during the 1970s and 80s. And he had a profound impact. You know when you hear people sort of talking about postmodernism and post-structuralism and
yeah.
A lot of people talk about it in the sense of it ruined academia and it ruined literary studies. You know, he's the guy that ruined it.
Oh, he's a ruiner.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He's a ruiner.
You know what? You can't rebuild unless you burn it all down. I'm an American. I know that.
Well, you're doing very well at it.
Good job
on the world order being tumbled as we speak.
Well, yes.
But one of the interesting things about, if I can sum up the most interesting things I found about Foucault, two things. His theory on power. So his theory on power is that, and I'm really, don't send me a bloody email because I'm doing the Cliff Notes version and I get that. I'm dumbing it down.
No, summation is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for just
summation.
Sort of a paraphrase. These are the things I need.
He's pretty much going, the church and the king used to be in charge. We think we got rid of those. We did not get rid of power. It just moved. So his idea is based on the idea of I think it's either a 17th or 18th century prison design, uses it as a metaphor, where you have a guard sitting in the middle, you have open cells, Now, at any one point, the guard cannot see all the prisoners, but he may be able to see the prisoners. And Foucault says, this is how power operates. You may be being watched, so you behave.
That's interesting.
So if you think about that in terms of how a power operates, in other words, we police ourselves now. We think of ourselves as being much more free. Mm-hmm. You know, we got rid of the king. We don't accept the authority of the church unconditionally. Hey, guess what he says? Yeah, but you're dubbing on each other and you control yourself, which is arguably a more insidious form of power.
Well, that is interesting because, but how did he compare that to like some sort of serfdom? Like when the tendrils were much more on the people and everyone was controlled much more actively than to have, you know, the civilization process itself is such a long process, right?
For sure.
So maybe us policing ourselves is the next step to civilization.
I think again, far be it for me to jump into the mind of Foucault about Foucault, but I think he would argue we think of that as freedom. We think that we've come up with the idea of how to be, when in fact there's all these power structures happening that are so invisible to us
that
we don't even notice them.
Oh, interesting.
The obvious example for him would be he wrote four volumes called The History of Sexuality. And he talked about, he was a gay man, I think. And he talked about, he basically said those things in your life that you take for granted, i.e. what we now think of as heteronormativity. He's like, those things are the things that are most powerful and require most examination. So we have this idea in the West that we've got a progressive view of sexuality, that we used to have a very backward view that was, you know, gay bad, straight good. And now we're like, no, you know, rainbows and you can be whatever you want and, you know, gay people are fantastic. And he says, guess what? The very categories of gay and straight were made up by people who wanted to control you.
Right.
So you take those categories on, you are doing their work for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So that if like self-defining, like when he's not talking, I mean, he starts at the big picture of civilization and then he brings it down to the parts that where you don't know that you're being controlled and the parts
absolutely.
And so is he encouraging the examination of these things so that you cannot be controlled
he's not so much on the practical details there, Jackie.
classic philosopher.
Classic philosopher. I wouldn't say Michel Foucault is sitting there going, should Jackie join an activist group? You know, like He might have, but I think he's saying
70s and 80s,
careful.
That's when AIDS.
Absolutely.
That's when a young man's fancy turned to poking his penis into absolutely everybody without repercussion. And so did he live through that, to your knowledge?
Do you know what? I'm going to say that he did, but I didn't actually check.
Fair enough.
That, so I'm not sure. But he definitely lived through the gay rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons that I find him so fascinating is because he's not frightened to go not just countercultural mainstream culture, but countercultural within his own culture and say, hey, even taking on this as an identity is fraught. So if you look, for example, say the Romans, you know, or the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, who, you know, how many jokes have we heard about ancient Greeks bombing each other?
A lot of jokes.
Love it. Loving those jokes. He's like, if you look at that bisexual, whatever you want to call it, pansexual, whatever, behavior was common.
Right.
No one would have thought that you needed to then ascribe an identity to yourself. Whereas now, despite all the evidence showing that most human beings are somewhere on a spectrum of sexuality, now we're much more wedded to the idea you're one or the other.
Right.
So, is it a straight progress? Are we more progressive now? Or actually, has this sort of medical model of this is homosexual, this is heterosexual, controlled us more.
Ah, well, I think to some extent there, I mean, there are philosophers who say the more we change, the more we stay exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that there's, I mean, the real changes are if everybody has a place to live, if everybody has clean water, if everybody has a chance at education and food, shelter and water. And then the next
Maslow's needs. Yeah.
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 And, and so
I think it's that it's about the pragmatics, but it's also about the way I think of it is don't be too smug. You know, when you think, for example, oh, well, we don't torture people anymore. I mean, we actually do, but let's assume for a moment that we don't. We don't physically torture people anymore. Yeah, but we still mentally torture people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if one thing that isolation during coronavirus has taught us is how stupid those people are that kind of go, prison's easy. Like, how I'd be fine.
Right, right. Iced
tea.
You're
in your own home with Netflix and cups of hot cocoa and you're losing it.
Yeah, yeah. I believe I was telling, because my dad was just telling me that he's like, I actually feel incarcerated. And I said,
yes.
And my father's 84. And I said, well, you know what Iced Tea said? And I tried to explain who Iced Tea was. And he said, I know who Iced Tea is, Jackie. Oh.
Does he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. He's, I love him so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I said, you know, cause 4 days, 4 or 5 days into essentially the first wave of hunkering down, right? Like in mid March here in Los Angeles or the United States. Iced Tea said, yeah, let's hear from all of you jackasses who said that you could solve, that solitary would be fine.
Yes,
you're
all
losing
right.
your shit and you're 5 days into living in your condo. So
absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, before comedy, I used to work in welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with adolescents, women, some men, but mostly adolescents and women coming out of prison. And most of them had been in for very minor crimes, usually crimes of poverty.
Right.
Because I do think you've got to separate out violent crime. That is a different thing. But the damage that had been wrought on them by the prison system, and in Australia our prison system, from what I gather relative to yours, is actually quite civil.
Oh.
But even then, it sends people mad.
Yeah. The last 40 years in the United States has actually just been a shit show of law and order politics that has created just a vicious cycle. And I used to do a joke about how did you guys know that we were going to be the bad guys in World War III? Until about 4 years ago in Canada, a guy in the fourth row yelled, "We knew. We totally knew."
Oh.
And I was like, "What?" He said, "How long have you known?" Yeah. He said, "We've known for decades." Anyway, and I was like, fuck. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
I mean, I don't want to pile on, but it looks that way from here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I'm sitting in the eye of the storm over here.
I know,
and I can
I know.
See it. And it isn't pretty, but, and it's interesting that people can't see that we're living through a civil war and there's no, just because nobody's lining up and shooting at each other anymore.
Yeah.
So
that's not how war is, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like one of the other subjects I was going to dork out on until you made me narrow it was the West Wing.
And oh, that's on this list.
That's, I know. It's on one of the lines I love from the West Wing is basically an admiral in your Navy, your imaginary West Wing Navy.
Yeah.
Kind of talking about, he's like, I don't know when it's war and when it's peace anymore. And he gives an example of, you know, if a pregnant woman is prepared to strap a suicide bomber vest to herself and walk into a market, this is not war as we know it.
Right.
You know, like you can be at war without a shot being fired.
And in the United States, shots are fired every single day.
Oh,
so
yeah, I
there's,
know.
I mean, the thing, if you want to talk about civil war, there is nothing, mass murders are, those are political acts and they are, they're civil, it's,
Well, and your incarceration rates, I mean, you know, I'm telling you something you already know, but we don't have the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little appetite for the death penalty in Australia. There'd be some.
Yeah. You know,
there's always some outliers, but we don't have the death penalty. The idea that the death penalty could be applied to minors.
Yeah.
In your country, like it baffles me. It would baffle even right-wing people here,
yeah.
Honestly. Even if they were pro-death penalty, the idea that it would be applied to children,
yes,
is like unfathomable.
It's unfathomable until you meet the person in any country, whether it's Australia or anywhere, that is a white supremacist. And they're for like, sure. Oh, then let us kill these brown and black children. And Asian children, yeah. And trans children, all of it.
And let me not for a second take the high moral ground. If any of you know anything about Australian politics, you'll know that we torture our asylum seeker and refugee brothers and sisters almost as much, maybe
right.
even more.
Right. So what,
you know,
I mean,
I'm not taking the high moral ground by any means.
Right now, this Dork Forest is about some shitty white people, you guys. That's what we're really bringing
well,
it.
But you know what? If you really want me to, let's bring it back to Michel Foucault.
Let's
come
please.
Back to the French. And I think one of the reasons that I loved reading his work is because things that are taken for granted, and for some people, the idea of eye for an eye, which is really what the death penalty is taken for granted. The idea if you commit a crime, you should be punished, is taken for granted. The idea that if someone comes into your country, quote unquote, illegally, not illegal according to international law, but let's put that aside, someone is an illegal entrant, that they should be punished. These are things we need to critique.
Mm-hmm.
These
mm-hmm.
are things we need to unpack and go, actually, what informs my view of that? This is not a view that's written in stone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is a made-up human thing, so think it through.
Right, right. And then the way he narrowed it down. So he wrote 4 volumes about human sexuality?
Yeah.
Was it 4?
But really, as a metaphor for this stuff, because I think particularly if you think of in the 70s, certainly in Australia, homosexuality was still considered to be a mental illness.
Right.
For example,
right.
or punishable by imprisonment. So he used it, I think, more as a metaphor to kind of go, you have got a base assumption. This is just one example. You've got a base assumption that people are born heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Our systems are set up that way, even though history tells us, nature tells us the opposite.
Right.
Every survey since Kinsey has told us the opposite.
Yeah.
But we still have this assumption. So have a look at that and recognize the way power works is not top down anymore. Why do you believe this?
Right. So that is...
when you know the opposite.
Right. And that is true of almost all beliefs, right? I mean, those...
almost everything.
A lot of that stuff isn't legislated, but it is common. It's commonly agreed upon.
Yeah, absolutely. Think of another example would be home ownership. How many people would you find, whether left wing, right wing, whatever wing, whatever limb, who these days... would say, it's an odd idea that you could own land, that you could own land that no one else could share.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you looked at our Aboriginal Australian history,
mm-hmm.
complete anathema. That would be like saying owning God.
Right. Right. You can't own the sky.
Land can't be owned.
Yeah.
You can't own the sky.
Yeah.
You know, if you're homeless, I'm homeless.
Yeah.
There is no homeless because we all share.
Right.
So we take for granted, me included, we take for granted the idea that home ownership is not only good,
right,
but our right.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Foucault, I imagine, were he here in my dining room, would say, well, let's have a think about that. Where does that come from?
Yeah.
That belief is underpinned by other belief systems and they usually benefit the powerful.
Right. They are people who want to control... it's all control issues, I think. And it's
yeah.
and that's, I suppose, the nature of power is to feel like you have some control over something, even if it's just power over your own day and your own
yes.
your own emotions.
Whereas I think he's saying, you think you're in control,
mm-hmm.
you know, but actually it's like the way your mum controls you, you know, with
yeah.
like guilt and surveillance.
Right, right, right. It's all suggestion.
Yeah, it's all, you do whatever you want, just do this or I won't love you.
Yeah.
You know, like it's this kind of, it's a false sense of control that we have is I think the way that I would sum it up.
Okay. That is fascinating because there's, you know, especially in this time of quarantine where yes. I have to spend a good portion of my time reminding myself that I don't have. And it's literally
yeah.
one day at a time. And yep. I literally have to think to myself, well, I can't think about September. It is May. No. It is May. And if I think,
and I keep bucking against that, mm-hmm. you know, like a child having a tantrum. Mm-hmm. Like I keep going, right, I'm going to book a trip to Bali.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? I probably won't be going to Bali for 2 years.
Right, right.
Who knows when I'll be going to Bali?
Right.
But I'm like, I'll get a good deal.
Right. There's an amazing Descent. Deal available if I want to yeah. go absolutely anywhere. But, yeah. you know, I mean, but you could start thinking of these things in the future where yeah. you're like, well, I want to do this or if yeah. will I ever do this yeah. or don't will I ever yourself? Because will I ever yourself yeah. will just paralyze you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to get into the I'm not a religious person, but I'm trying to get into the sort of Buddhist idea of kind of the only moments now, which is of course the truth, but one we spend our whole lives escaping.
Right.
You know, and it's forcing us to do that. No, you can't escape mentally by imagining yourself in Bali in December, Nelly, because you don't know if you can travel.
Right.
So just deal with your reality today.
Right. I like to think I'm not good at living in the now either. So the way I trick myself into it is I go, what is the next indicated action? What is yeah. the only thing that you can do next that would be of yeah. any use to fucking yeah. anyone? And yeah, yeah. So that keeps me in a moment yeah. that isn't too far
just
ahead.
Not this one.
Right. It isn't the one where I'm just sitting here sort of making sure my shoulders aren't up, you know? It is the
but
next.
You know what? Our job is by definition like that, don't you reckon? I mean, it's that metaphor of like sitting in some shitty hotel all day mm-hmm. waiting for the 1 hour that you're going to work. You know?
Yeah.
It's like you're always waiting for that next thing that's not that far away.
I spent the day.
It isn't now.
I spent the day looking forward to this.
Me too.
Right.
Of course. Are you nuts?
It's 9 o'clock at night on Friday yeah. here, and I don't have a set. I don't have a stand-up set yeah. until tomorrow night, Saturday night. So I was like, well, can I pick up a set? And I was yeah. like, I don't know. You know, in real life, I could pick up a set.
Yeah, of course.
But to pick up a set on Zoom, I would have to throw it out there that on the internet, I'm like, is anybody doing a Zoom show?
Yeah.
Or I would have to run my own Zoom show, which I just yeah. did on Thursday. And I don't necessarily, I did an amazing show, quite honestly.
Yeah.
Would have been, I think, last night or the night before. Oh yeah. No, it was yesterday because I did my hour that I'm trying to get my hour together.
You're working up a show. Yep.
Yep. And then I had a radio interview for the show for tomorrow night, for the Saturday night show. And I forgot that I had a show over the internet that was happening in Utah. So I logged into the Utah show and I was exhausted, right? Because I had already been yelling into the internet for an hour and a half. I'm mic'd. There's absolutely no reason for me to yell. But for some reason, I feel like I have to get to Melbourne, right?
Yeah.
By yelling.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And
yeah. Do you know my theory on stand-ups? I can't remember. I may have told you this 15 years ago, but people always think that stand-ups are extroverts, which we both know is not true.
Not.
Like there's many. In fact, most of us are introverts. But my theory on stand-ups is not that we want to be the center of the party or the center of attention. It is that we come from families, usually, where we didn't feel seen or heard.
Well.
And so, hence the reason, as who we are. So, we might have been paid attention to, but, you know, do you see who Jackie really is? Do you see who Nelly really is? So, I've got to yell to fucking LA.
Right.
For someone to hear me.
Aren't you the youngest of five or something?
No, my mum's from a family of 12 and my dad has 9 brothers.
Oy.
So, it's out of control.
That's so many people.
It's so many people. And also, as I indicated before, like I wasn't exactly the prototypical Thomas.
No, you went to college. You were like, I am. My second older, I'm the youngest of six, and my four older brothers, the youngest of the boys, he was like, you guys are out of your minds if you think I'm not getting out of here and going to college.
Yeah.
And then my sister, who's just above me, has the exact same attitude. The two of them, I feel like they came to the decision at parallel times. And they have always been like, no, I came up with it. No, I came up with it. And and they're a year and a half apart. So, but what was interesting, the interesting thing about that was that they both came up with it. And then they both looked at me and said, that's what you're doing too. And I was like, wait,
yeah, off you go.
I want to learn how to make birdhouses in shop class. No, you're taking geometry and you're going to go to university.
Totally. I mean, it was kind of at that time, so we're talking sort of 1980s in my case, like it was definitely opening up more in Australia for more working class kids and especially more girls to consider going to university. So I had sort of cultural factors that were encouraging me. But to give you some idea, I worked all through high school at a place called Chicken Treat, sometimes called Big Rooster when the owners change it. They're like a fast food chicken place.
Is it Chicken Treat?
Chicken Treat or Big Rooster.
Or Big Rooster. Cock-a-doodle-doo.
Yes, who was the rooster?
You were
the... Yes. I was the rooster. I'm dressed in the rooster suit for the kids' parties.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Imagine me, rural Western Australia, 45 degrees heat, which I don't know how to convert it to yours, but it's like over 100. It's fucking hot.
That's too hot.
And you're in this giant rooster suit on a freeway, which is where the outlet was, doing kids' parties in the car park. That's me for 5 years.
Oh my, 5 years.
5 years.
Did not see that coming. Did not see how long that portion of your life lasted. Did not see that coming.
Yeah. So at the end of high school, I was offered the job as manager at Chicken Treat. So I had the option to either manage Chicken Treat in my hometown or go to university. Which one do you think my parents wanted me to do?
Oh, I relate to this 100%. I know they wanted you. They're like, it's a management position.
Put your apron on, bitch.
In 12 years, you could be regional manager. This is a thing.
You might own a franchise.
You could own a franchise. holy shit. Could you please shut up? I worked at a footlong hot dog stand for 3 summers. Also to be referred to as alcoholism. But because you know what? You know what's a pretty plug and play kind of gig? Working at a hot dog stand. Anyway.
Oh, indeed. And I worked in a crayfish factory. You do? Are they called crayfish in America or something else?
Yeah, crayfish. Yeah.
Crayfish factory. And let's just say there was a lot of reggae music played. if I could put it that way in terms of the kinds of substances that were being consumed.
Sure. It wasn't a heavy thinker job.
There was a lot of passing the peace pipe.
Yeah. You could blaze up and then keep sorting out your crabs from your non-crabs.
And you know what? We had to drown out the sound because in those days, apologies to vegetarians, but the crayfish were cooked live.
Oh, yeah.
So they would be chucked into a giant vat of boiling water and all you could hear is
You don't have to act it out. That's good.
So but that was just, if you're not stoned, you're not going to get through that shit.
No. I have to tell you that speaking of sound is I could hear something in the background and it was your dog just shaking like a leaf.
It's my dog. I'm going to put him out because I think he needs to do a wee. Can you hold him
sure? Sec? All right. Did you guys hear that? Dog has to do a wee. That's a thing they say in Australia. Let's look at her. Let's look at the background there. Look, there's a little kid. I'm gonna post this Zoom video, so that'll be fun for everybody. But this is real nice. We got a nice picture of the child right there, and then underneath it, there seems to be some sort of. Is that a picture underneath?
My apologies.
That's okay. Underneath the picture of your child behind you, is that a picture of a Zoom meeting that you've recently gotten? Framed.
So that is little tags. I literally put that up a couple of weeks ago because it's either places that I have been overseas or want to go overseas.
Oh, it's a little vision board.
It's a little vision. Oh, God. Now we're getting into Oprah. And by coincidence, the little cat picture next to it was gifted to me by our mutual friend Maria Bamford when I directed one of her shows.
She left me a message today because she got your letter. I got your letter.
My proper letter.
You sent a couple of proper letters, and they were long. They were handwritten. They were beautiful. I sent you a postcard.
I wasn't going to mention it. I love that postcard, though.
Is it the one with the thing on fire?
No, not the actual postcard. Oh. I love just getting a postcard from you.
Oh, that was nice.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
There's nothing wrong with that. And let's talk. What did you like? I saw some of the West Wing. Andrew Solomson used to have a joke about the West Wing. He said,
is it about white people? Let me preempt. Is it about white people, middle-class people loving it?
No, he said the West Wing is sort of porn for liberals. And
totally.
And he said, but you know what? You get the government and the girlfriends you deserve. So,
and the porn you deserve.
And the porn that you actually do not deserve.
Yeah, true. What did I love about it? Look, I mean, I think it's your classic. I have to insert the caveats now because I think in some ways, and I've heard, what's his name? Played
Martin
one of the main
Sheen.
Act, Bradley Whitford. Bradley Whitford, who plays Josh Lyman, and he's also in The Handmaid's Tale.
And I follow him on Twitter. He's sane.
He is sane.
Yeah.
And he's amazing. But I agree with him that even though he was obviously, like, integral to the West Wing, he kind of says it sort of fucked liberal politics in America because it gave a lot of kind of lefty-leaning, you know, communista feministas the false impression that a kind of liberal vision of government could sort of triumph easily.
Mm.
And what that would look like. I mean, again, going back to Foucault, let's not kid ourselves about the West Wing, even though I love it.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely a middle-class white woman's wet dream.
It's a fairy tale.
It is.
It is completely
it's entirely a fairy tale.
Yes.
But it also keeps intact. You know, there's still a white guy running the place.
Mm-hmm.
He's Catholic. You know, daddy's still in charge.
Yeah, he's still a father figure.
He's still a father figure.
He's a swinging dick, clear and brush in front of the world. It's very irritating in the way that, you know, because you think of, is it Allison Janney?
Yes.
Okay.
CJ.
CJ, yes. Yeah. I mean, how about her as president? Because incredibly competent, like plate spinner galore.
Yeah.
And,
but do you know what? In some ways, this is where you get into an argument about creating culture versus reflecting culture. One argument would be, well, that reflects culture. Because, you know, as if Alison Janney or CJ Craig, as if CJ Craig in the real world gets elected president of the United States, she does not.
She does not.
So in that sense, it's realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it also keeps perpetuating this idea that things feel really nice when the old white guy's in charge.
Right.
And that is what President Bartlett is.
If the old white guy were sane. If the old white guy were genuinely the nerd that we need, you know?
Oh, totally. Look, I think if I can answer your original question, which is why I love it, it is because I am drawn to dystopian visions. I nerd out on The Handmaid's Tale. You know, I go to like all of those political dramas
that are super sad.
And I need a counter to that. And The West Wing is a counter to that. It is a utopian vision in the sense that even the Republicans are thoughtful, intelligent. They disagree with the government in power,
mm-hmm.
but they are not mean-spirited.
They just have a
different vision. They're not evil.
Did you ever see The American President, though, with Michael Douglas, written by Sorkin as well?
Yes.
Okay. Because in that, I think it's Richard Dreyfuss plays a Republican piece of shit, like a terrible person. And he is mean-spirited, and he is manipulative and doesn't, you know, I've told this story a couple of times. I don't know that I've ever actually told it on a podcast, but one of my brothers is a Republican, and he has always been, when he was small, he was the first one to go to college, right? And right. He wanted to be Alex P. Keaton from Family.
Yes, of course he did.
Yes, he fell in
Family Ties.
Family Ties. He fell in love with Alex P. Keaton. So he has always, he's been a lifelong Republican. But during the last election, he said that he voted for Hillary Clinton. And as did my father, who had, I believe I told you what my father had to say about. But the thing about Russ is that Russ has always claimed, you know, he's like, he's an old school conservative. But when when we all went into shutdown, right, in the beginning of March, Russ owns rental properties, both residential and commercial. And
Alex P. Keaton.
And he called them and he sent out emails and phone calls to all of his properties and said, nobody owes me rent until July.
Oh, bless.
And I said, you are a terrible Republican.
Yeah.
And he's
an asshole.
And he's like, no, I don't want to find new tenants. And you know, what is it? 20? Who cares? It's 20 grand. Who cares? And I was like, no, that's because you're sane. Right?
Totally. Yeah. But I think, well, that's interesting because, say, Alan Alda, in the later seasons, and again, for any proper dorks who love The Wing, they'll know there's Sorkin Wing and post-Sorkin Wing. So Sorkin Wing, for example, if I put my feminist hat on, far more gender problems.
Oh, okay.
Post-Sorkin Wing, still not perfect.
Sure.
But CJ, as an example, gets a lot more power and is much more well-drawn, as is Donna. A few other characters. But in the post-Sorkin era, we have Alan Alda playing Arnold Vinnick, who's a Republican president. Now, he's a centrist. He's basically a quite radically Republican economist.
Okay.
But relatively socially progressive in the sense that, for example, he would say, well, if you want to get an abortion, it's nothing to do with me.
Right.
I'm not telling you to get one or not get one, but, you know, I believe in small government, so you make that call for yourself. He's a proper fucking Republican,
right,
is what I'm
right.
saying.
Old school conservative.
Old school.
Right, but also believes in roads and clean water.
Sure,
you know, what the heck, the electricity. Yeah.
Sure.
He gets it.
Sure.
He would like it to be more efficient. That is Ruskation, by the way. So.
Yeah. But I guess what I like about it is if you step back again philosophically, the best possible scenario, I am avowedly left-wing and I'm more than happy to talk about what that means, but let me just put that ahead of this statement. I still think the best possible scenario is to have a competent right and a competent left and for the fringe dwellers of both to be the minority and to be kind of lampooned.
Yeah, by
so
everyone.
On the wing.
Yeah.
Like by everyone. Mm-hmm. And on the West Wing, you have a vision, unrealistic as it is, you have a vision of what that might look like. When you go, actually, I don't agree with you, Arnold Vinnick, that this is how we get a better society, but I understand that your intentions are good. That you're an intelligent person, that you're not mean-spirited, that you want, in your case, a great America. I just disagree with you on how to get there, but we do have a lot in common.
Right. Right.
So we've lost that. I mean, we've lost that in Australia too, but you guys have certainly fucking lost it. So I need the wing. It's like candy.
Right, which is why it was so weird to me that you also put A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf on here.
Yeah, yeah.
I have never been able to finish a Virginia Woolf book. What am I missing with A Room of One's Own?
Well, can I just put a pin in the fact that when you came on my podcast, you told me to read a fucking book because I said I loved the Kardashians. So, you know, right back at your girlfriend.
Right. Well, and I'm not saying that she's not a classic and that this is not clearly a book that has been beloved. But there's plenty of things.
To make you put your head in the oven. I get it.
Right. Right.
The reason I chose it, I thought it was funny given that we can't leave our houses. So A Room of One's Own, you know, at the moment being in confined spaces, you realize how important literal space is. So Virginia Woolf, it's basically two essays, and her central point is both literally saying female writers, in particular female creatives, need a space to be creative. So fuck knows, aren't we learning that now? You know, idea that you can have kids at home running around doing homeschool and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't think men have understood the impact of that on women's careers, especially women who are mothers.
Right.
It's impossible if you don't have your own space.
Yeah.
But she also means metaphorically. So she means women need independence. And I feel like I'm getting a bit dystopian handmaids here, but I feel like we've become a bit complacent around this idea. So I'm hearing a lot of women, myself included, kind of questioning work-life balance stuff. Can I really work? How much work can I do? And I guess for me, it's just a reminder, give up that financial independence at your peril. You know, before I worked in comedy, as I said, I worked in welfare, I worked in domestic violence refuges for a while. And I know that that's the extreme end, but I remember a fellow worker saying to me once, basically, if I could say something to every woman in the world, it would be have $5,000 in the bank that no one knows about. You never know when you need to leave.
Right.
And that stayed with me 25 years later.
Yeah.
So a room of one's own, to me, that the metaphor of it is around that, is kind of going, give up your independence very carefully.
Right.
Don't just assume everything's going to be okay. Don't just assume you will never need that financial independence. Obviously, it was assumed for centuries, for millennia, that women's dependence on men was
a nothing. Given.
Didn't matter. A given.
Yeah.
We know now that that is not a good situation.
No, that we're kind of forgetting. The balance of power is very different. But I think it's so interesting. I might have mentioned on your podcast about this amazing article I read. I read about the history of department stores.
Oh, and no, tell me.
In the 1860s, department stores were invented. A guy named Rowland Macy created Macy's. Yeah, a guy named Edward Filene. His dad created Filene's Basement. Oh, Edward created Filene's Basement, which was a discount department store. But department stores were invented in the United States in the late 1800s. They took off as places where respectable women could leave the home. Yeah. And previously, respectable women had to have shit brought to them so they could pick whatever they wanted. And that's why, have you ever heard that men shop, men buy things and women shop?
No. And
it's a horrible, it's an old trope. It's an old hack joke. It's like, bitches, man, they love to shop. And men, we just go and we buy stuff. And you're like, right. Well, it's because there used to just be stores where you would have to go and get things. Department stores were created as an experience with different departments where women would go with their friends, and they would, and it was because of the industrial revolution. More crap was being produced. So there had to be a place to sell all different kinds of crap to more people. Mm. And what this did was it allowed women to leave the home unsupervised. Mm. And it gave, since most of the employees were women, so that those women felt safe, it gave those women incomes. Shitty incomes where they had to live all piled as cordwood, you know, in small apartments. But it created this revolution of this department stores. And when I read about it, I read several pieces about it, just articles, and it made me feel guilty how much I loathe shopping, because imagine being trapped in your home. Not hard to imagine. You're allowed to leave, but like one of the places you could go would be to a department store, which would also have a tea shop. Mm. And it would also have a place where you could meet other friends, and you could go look at things and you could talk and you could have kind of an outing.
And Elizabeth Moss walks by in a bonnet. and, you know, under his fucking eye. I mean, going back to Foucault, I keep coming
Please.
Back to Michel, but I think, so this is a really sad story, and I'm sorry, but last year a female comedian from Melbourne was murdered, was raped and murdered walking home from a gig.
I saw
and,
that.
Yeah, it was I absolutely horrendous. One of the predictable response, which happens every time that there's a high-profile murder of a woman, which is rare in Australia, to be honest, but a high-profile murder of a woman outside the home. So we have an epidemic of domestic violence where women are killed by husbands and boyfriends and exes, but we're not used to women being killed by strangers, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
The predictable response was talks of curfews. So should women be out
what?
At night?
Holy
should
shit.
Should women be getting taxis? Should women be, you know, insert other restriction here?
Walking and around
again,
without a male escort.
The rage in me of going, if we are going to have a curfew for anybody because women aren't safe at night, how about the dudes stay home?
Yeah.
They're fucking killing us.
Right. They're the ones that are...
I mean, the default, have a look again, going to back to Foucault, what is the underlying assumption? Men have a right to be out.
Yeah.
Men have a right to do what the fuck they want.
Right.
Including stopping me going out because I might get raped or murdered. That's your solution?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's so funny because I've been working on this bit for the last couple of years about this very thing about how if you want to treat people like people, look at how a straight white guy treats another straight white guy. That's your bar, right?
Yes.
And there are some punchlines in it, but there's almost you know, it started out there was almost too much rage. And I was like, but I have to talk about this, so I don't know how to get to the funny without processing the rage, which is sometimes what I do with stand-up, you know? And I sandwich it in between jokes that are done. And it's harder when we are living in this situation and the rage kind of bleeds over. Like there's rage of me as a woman. There's rage of me learning about racism. Thought I knew. Turns out.
Yeah, sure.
Turns out that's also a well without a bottom that I maybe I could shut up and listen is
Foucault
what I've
might
recently.
Have some ideas on that too.
Mm. So it's been interesting. The belief system dork out has been kind of fascinating, Nellie Thomas. We're coming up on an hour. People should know that I'm talking to Nellie Thomas, you guys. It's in the notes. NellieThomas.com.
From Australia.
I'm watching an Australian shitty mystery show, and I'm watching a New Zealand shitty mystery show. And and they're both adorable, and I love them to pieces.
New Zealand's our Canada. You know, we like to think that they're just like, we just subsume them. But in fact, we all aspire to Kiwis, really. And how does this work, Jackie? Do we need to get through all the topics or we just like round up now?
We round up. It's all good. We say, we got to have you back. And when I say we, it's more of a royal we.
Look, I would be absolutely in love with the idea of having, because I did homework for you, Jackie, with the Weezer words.
Right. I sent you three things.
We're going to do that later. Yeah, I've done it. I've got
what
it ready,
it?
Girl.
What are they for?
It will require about 5 or 10 minutes.
It's fine.
Yeah. You do that? So there's and I recommend anyone who's interested in politics or ideas or indeed like life or culture to look this up. There's an Australian author who used to be a speechwriter called Don Watson, and he wrote a book. I think it's called Weasel Words, but you'll be able to find it. And essentially the gist of it is he is saying that the corporatization of public language, you know, that managerial speak, like we're downsizing, we're not sacking people, you know, all of that kind of shit.
Mm-hmm.
We've got an action plan. We're going to rebrand, you know, that has so insidiously seeped into public language, even in welfare even in education.
Could you tell me how to monetize education real quick? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have a 7-point plan for that. We just need to rebrand. But he taught, I think it's really actually interesting to reflect on in the era of Trump, because I am not for one second going to suggest that, you know, there are not multiple reasons for the election of a sociopath like Trump. But I think one of them, just one of them is that both sides of politics have used the kind of language that is impenetrable to large swathes of the world, certainly of America, that makes an us and them kind of environment that is snobby, is up yourself. And when someone like Trump walked in, sociopath though I think he is, and spoke in a different way, they went, oh, you're one of mine. Even though he's born to a multimillionaire, oh, yes, you sound like I sound.
Mm-hmm.
You're plain spoken.
Oh,
you know,
right,
you're an average guy.
Because of his language usage.
Because of his language. And that stuff, it's not all the explanation by any means for Trump. I am not suggesting that for a second.
No.
But we have a similar kind of vibe of things going in Australia with different politicians. And coming from where I come from, which is, you know, would be Trump territory if we're in America, we can't ignore how alienating the language of politics and society has been for that group of people, and what a vacuum that that created for right-wing, usually, lunatics to swoop in and say, I'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Until we start speaking properly. And the homework I did, which is by the by, I asked Jackie to just nominate three places and I would look up three companies, charities, whatever they are. Doesn't matter if they're good or bad. Doesn't matter if we love them or we hate them.
Mm-hmm.
For me to look at their mission statement as a demonstration. I did not choose these.
No.
You chose them.
I did choose them.
Right? So would you like me to give you
essentially
a little demo?
Show me that they're using that sort of that corporate speak?
You know that they are.
I know that they
are. You know they are. So give MN, which is one of the ones that you suggested, their vision. And bless them, because they're hearts of gold. They give us with hearts of gold. We envision an unparalleled state of giving, a Minnesota where innovative technology and creative ideas help each person's generosity soar to its full potential. What the fuck does that mean? Like, seriously, could we not bring that down to, we want you to be more generous and we'll help you do it?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Roosevelt Institute. Until the rules work for every American, they're not working. The Roosevelt Institute is a think tank and campus network that believes in an economy and democracy by the people for the people. The few at the top, corporations and the richest among us, hold too much wealth and power today, and our society will be stronger when that changes. Are you still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Armed with a bold vision for the future, we want our work to move the country toward a new economic and political system, one built by many for the good of all. Okay. I have rewritten that for you, Jackie Cation.
Mm-hmm.
Our vision is to make America more equal. We want wealth and power to be shared by the many, not the few.
Right.
Can we say what we mean? Fair fight was my favourite of the three, but their vision statement was 180 words long.
Right.
I'm like, can't we just go, at fair fight, we believe the voting system's rigged. We want to fix it.
Yeah.
Like, why do we have to, my fear is that we have to make things so complicated and so elaborate and complex so we feel like what we're doing is important. And I want to say, you know whether or not your work is important.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to trick it up.
Right.
Just tell us what you're doing and own it.
Right. Right, right.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense. I see why you would, you know, sort of pick it apart and go, yeah, this is too much language to just say, we want you to be more generous. And that was my favorite one. That was the favorite one that you
For
wrote.
For sure. They're great.
Yeah.
They're
I want great. You to be more generous and we're going to help you learn
we'll
how to do that.
We'll help you do it.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't have to make me feel better. You don't have to pretend you're doing something other than what you're doing. It's like when corporations get on the classic one for any working class person. Oh, we're going to downsize. What you're going to do is you're going to sack people.
Yeah.
Why can't you say, own it, if you need to sack people, why can't you say, we need to get rid of some jobs, we need to sack people, it's devastating, we're really sorry, we have to do it for these reasons. Do not pretend to me that you're downsizing, which sounds like, I don't know, you're just shrinking a cupcake.
Right. Well, and it's, you know? I mean, but the language is, I mean, I know, I think it was George Carlin or whoever talked about PTSD versus shell shock or whatever, right?
Yes.
And it's the same thing where the more words you use, the less everyone knows what the hell you're doing, or they don't have a grasp of where the shell game is, which is interesting because I haven't listened to a president of the United States speak.
No, you rage, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, for this reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so that, and when I say I read, I skim the transcripts. And because it's almost like I'm looking at a contract. And when I look at a contract, I look for dollar signs. And when I read a script, I look for discrepancies. I look for, you know, a switch.
Follow the money.
Yeah, bait and switch. I look for, you know, the shell game that is often anybody, even people that I supported. You know, it doesn't mean.
Of course. Especially people you support. This is, again, to go, I mean, I feel like a dog with a bone, to go back to Foucault, this is how power operates. You know, when you start, as we did when I was working in welfare, you start referring to the people you work with as clients. Client. Now it's just assumed that people are clients. What's a client? A client's someone who buys something off you. It's an economic transaction.
Yeah.
It is the complete antithesis of what welfare work is. Welfare work is about humans.
Yeah.
It is about care. It is about love. It's about equality. And yet even you couldn't get more left wing than a bunch of social workers.
Yeah.
Even calling people all just swallowed it.
What would you call them besides clients? What did they used to be called?
People.
Just people?
Just people.
These are these are the people I'm working with.
These are the people I'm working with.
These are the people I'm working with. And for and to working together with, whatever. But you just call people. Yeah.
People, the way that power operates is that that client especially sets up a relationship where I have the product and you need to earn it from me.
Yeah.
So if I work in housing, for example, well, Jackie, if you're a good girl, I'll get you some housing.
Hmm.
But if you're not a nice client, I'll give it to somebody else.
Right, because
Working with people, working with humans, working in welfare and performing service means I don't care if I fucking hate your guts. I will find you a house because you have a right to housing.
Yeah. Nellie Thomas, that it does matter. This has been fascinating, and I still like you, it turns out, 15 years later. What I like to do is be reintroduced to friends of mine from 1,000 years ago.
I found we look the same though.
We do look
better. We look good. Oh, girl, we're aging well.
It's all coming together. What? Anyway, but I will say that I did find that picture of you and Locke from 15 years ago. That was weird, right?
Yeah, totally weird. Totally weird. But that's lovely. Thank you. We had 20 years together this year, this week.
Right.
It's our 20th anniversary. Went down a little walk down memory lane. So interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, thank you. It's lovely. Thank you for having me on. And I hope I was as clear as one can be with such complexity.
I think you were. And hang on for a second. Let me just close out the show. Rangers, you know how I close out the show. It's a thank you for listening to the Dork Forest. And you know the rules. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?